Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Bradfield, Judge Cleary, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding. Now calling the case of State versus Stewart, A20488.
And when you begin your argument, please state your name for the record. That this is being recorded and will be posted on our website. So Ms. Graff.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, my name is Leah Graff. I represent the appellant Terry Stewart in this matter. When this court first considered Mr. Stewart's claims, it was quite concerned about the constitutional issues that they raised. And it was not the first time that this court expressed some concern about the registration statute operating at a constitutional tipping point. This court understandably believed that Boughton versus LaFleur controlled, but in Wuerlich versus Schnell, the Minnesota Supreme Court untethered this court from Boughton. And based on an analysis of the current registration obligations and consequences, Mr. Stewart could not constitutionally be required to register and ask this court to permit him to withdraw his guilty plea to failure to register. There are a number of constitutional claims at issue in this case, and I would like to start this morning by addressing Mr. Stewart's claim under the Stigma Plus Doctrine, which is a procedural due process claim, and then discuss whether the registration statute is punitive. Under the Stigma Plus Doctrine—
Before you begin, mm-hmm. When I read your most recent brief, you talked about an as-applied challenge, I think 7 times. And so is your constitutional challenge an as-applied challenge?
Yes, the argument and the relief requested is a determination that the statute is unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Stewart, who was charged with but never convicted of a predatory offense.
And the other thing, we went back through the record, we couldn't find the district court order that you're appealing from in the record.
The appeal is from the judgment of conviction and sentence for the guilty plea to the offense of failure to register.
Okay, so there was never, and you're requesting to withdraw the plea at this point.
Correct.
I just want to make sure I understand procedurally. So there was never a motion to withdraw the plea in district court?
There was not a motion to withdraw in district court. The argument was raised on appeal to withdraw the plea based on the fact that if he couldn't constitutionally be required to register, he couldn't be prosecuted or convicted of failing to register, and that without his conduct being criminal, the court lacked subject matter jurisdiction to accept the guilty plea. And that's, the court proceeded on that basis in its prior opinion to address the claims.
Okay, and so I just read the sentencing transcript again, and it was your client who raised the issue that he didn't think it was fair that he had to register because of a charge that was dismissed. And that was his sole complaint when I read the sentencing transcript.
Yes, I believe it was discussed at sentencing with the court.
Okay, thank you.
Yes. So under the Stigma Plus Doctrine, due process protections are required when there's a reputational injury coupled with the loss of some other tangible interest in an altered legal status. So in Boughton, the court said there isn't a recognizable interest in merely updating an address. But as this court's aware, the registration statute now requires much more. And it's Stewart's position that there is a recognizable interest in being free from having to update and provide information regarding nearly every aspect of a registrant's life. That includes residence, secondary addresses, work, school, motor vehicle information, phone numbers, and also raises the possibility of in-person reporting obligations. The information that is required to be disclosed can be made public through several mechanisms, including when a registrant is out of compliance with the address reporting requirements. There's also healthcare notification and disclosure provisions that have been added to the statute since Boughton, and those require a registrant to report his status as a predatory offender before he receives services through a home healthcare provider or healthcare facility, that sets in motion then an obligation by law enforcement or a supervising agent to disclose a fact sheet to hospital administration and eventually to residents or their next of kin. Again, all of those changes since Boughton. So given sort of the large scale monitoring, disclosure and notification components of the statute that now exists, there is an altered legal status. Mr. Stewart's legal obligations are different than non-registrants, and his legal obligations exist now. If he doesn't comply with those legal obligations, he is subject to a mandatory commit to prison. And so that is, I think, more than sufficient to satisfy the plus aspect of the stigma plus doctrine.
So, Ms. Graff, I am trying very hard to stay on top of all the case law in this area, which is pretty difficult. So I could well have missed something. But in focusing on the Wuerlich opinion, it seems to me that before the Supreme Court got to an analysis of what procedural due process rights were at issue, they very carefully considered whether Mr. Wuerlich had a justiciable claim. And that has to do with whether he himself, I think, has been injured and presents a specific challenge to the registration requirements that are different from those that Boughton considered. And so you started mentioning some of those differences, but I'm not clear whether your client's, Mr. Stewart's claim is justiciable. I don't see it even argued by you. And of course, we can raise, because it affects our jurisdiction and our willingness to review issues, you know, we can raise justiciability. So how do you look at that issue?
Certainly. And I think respondent raised a ripeness issue as to the stigma plus claim in its supplemental brief. But I guess I would note that this court did consider the merits of the claim on the first appeal. And the argument that the stigma plus claim is not ripe, I think, misses the focus of the plus requirement. So the plus is not itself a loss of a liberty interest. It is enough for there to be an altered legal status that, coupled with reputational harm, rises to the level of warranting procedural protections. And I think that because under the mechanics of the registration statute itself, again, Mr. Stewart's legal obligations as we sit here today are different than yours and mine. And without compliance with those legal obligations, he faces the most severe consequence, you know, of mandatory prison sentences. And so I think this is actually consistent with Wuerlich's determination that in that case, his claim as to the right to parent was ripe. There was an argument about whether that claim was ripe given at that point Mr. Wuerlich's incarceration. And the court said the fact that he has alleged an intent to reside with his child is sufficient for the claim to be ripe. It wasn't necessary that the statute at issue, which treated his residence with his child as threatened child abuse and initiated an investigation, it wasn't required that had already been underway for the claim to be ripe. So I think it looks at what is his legal status, and that is consistent with Paul v. Davis. That's a U.S. Supreme Court case that says what we're looking at here is for some sort of altered legal position. And I think that that's clearly the case here.
So Ms. Graff, following up on Judge Bradford's case, in the Wuerlich case, the Supreme Court affirmed the district court's dismissal of almost all of his claims except the claim with regard to his right to parent. And so it dismissed, even for instance, the separation of powers claim that you raise, and that it would seem that Wuerlich may control that argument or be precedent for that argument. And so on this record, there isn't a record about the harm to your client. So there is a possibility of all of these consequences that may impact your client's life, but the record, we would be speculating about those, it seems, based on this record.
I guess I'd like to answer in two parts, and I'll start with where you left off first, which is whether it would be speculation about the impact of the statute on the client. And I disagree. I don't think that the court's speculating. It didn't speculate in its previous opinion. And Stewart's challenges are simply based on the registration statute's requirements of him. He has unquestionably been subject to registration. And so the question is, as he stands here today, is he required to take different steps and does he have different legal obligations in order essentially to remain free? And the answer to that is yes, there's no speculation about that. The Wuerlich case affirmed the dismissal of several claims on justiciability grounds, but they were very, one of them, for example, was that he didn't have the ability to challenge on free speech and Fourth Amendment grounds, certain conditions that only applied to level 3 offenders while he was a level 1 offender. That is, that claim was not justiciable because those conditions would not and could not apply ever to Mr. Wuerlich. Whereas here we're focused on the very fundamental aspects of the registration statute that apply to all registrants. So I think that's a meaningful difference. And then as to the separation of powers claim, Mr. Stewart's claim is different than the separation of powers claim in Wuerlich. And claim in Wuerlich was focused on limiting the prosecutorial discretion inconsistent with the separation of powers doctrine. Mr. Stewart's claim is that the court here didn't play a role in imposing registration. And that is, this case never proceeded to a probable cause hearing, and there was never any sort of judicial check on the allegation in the complaint of an enumerated offense. So that's distinct.
But typically, if there's going to be a probable cause hearing, it's because the defendant in district court challenges probable cause. And here the complaint was signed off on by a judge, and then there wasn't a challenge to that finding.
Well, regardless of whether the defendant brings a challenge to probable cause, if the matter proceeds to omnibus, the court is going to make a probable cause determination, whether that's over the defendant's objection or not. So that either way serves as a check.
I thought that procedurally, when a person pleads guilty, any pretrial motions get subsumed in that plea. So typically a probable cause challenge would go away once a person pleads guilty.
And this case simply never proceeded to that stage. And there was no reason for Mr. Stewart to know. And I think what the court's questions are getting at are really the lack of notice here. And there is no notice to a defendant that failing to challenge probable cause or not proceeding to a probable cause hearing where that challenge can be raised will result in registration if he is convicted of a non-enumerated offense, but that arises out of the same set of circumstances. So I think that the question is not whether he waived his right to challenge probable cause. The separation of powers question is, what was the court's role in this case, as distinguished from the court's role in other cases where this court has said, we're not concerned about separation of powers issues because the court evaluated probable cause here. But I think maybe more importantly, getting back to the stigma plus claim, is that we're looking at what procedures were implemented to let Mr. Stewart know of the consequence of any decision he made, and there are none. Respondent relies on a lot of procedural steps in the criminal process, but those are due process protections as they relate to the criminal charges. They are not targeted to, and they are not required to be noticed as protections as to the consequence of registration. So in that situation, there is really no procedural protection here. It's simply the operation of the statute that has caused Mr. Stewart to be subject to registration. And I see my time is almost up if there are no more questions.
Any questions from the panel? Seeing none, and you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Olson.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Ben Olson. I represent the state of Minnesota in this matter, the respondent. The Worley case sets out the analytical framework that this court has to apply when analyzing each of appellant's constitutional arguments. The parties seem to agree on what those standards are, so I don't want to regurgitate them here. What I want to do is kind of focus on some of the issues that the panel has been picking up on. I agree that, or at least believe that, there are a number of issues with the appellant's procedural due process claims. I think the first and foremost issue is ripeness. A lot of the claims that are made in the briefing are that the community notification provisions of the community notification statute or the healthcare facility notification provisions of the predatory offender statute satisfy the plus element of the stigma plus test. But I think as at least some of the panel has picked up on, the record doesn't demonstrate whether Mr. Stewart has been subject to any of those provisions, specifically the healthcare facility notifications provisions. The record doesn't demonstrate.
Mr. Olson, if you would respond to Ms. Graff's argument, she tried to draw, and I thought it was an interesting analogy to the claim that the Supreme Court analyzed in Wehrlich. So we have a father there, he's got a child, there are the consequences laid out in detail in the Supreme Court's opinion, enough that they did reverse and remand that for consideration and further analysis, strict scrutiny and procedural due process. So in that case, Mr. Wehrlich did not have to show a loss or that an actual investigation had been undertaken, only that he was subject to those requirements. That was how far the Supreme Court's analysis took it. Now, obviously there's a remand here and we'll see what happens at the end of the story, but doesn't that undercut your argument? I mean, at this point, is the only thing that's required for Mr. Stewart to show is the application of those plus requirements?
I don't believe so. And I think the important thing that needs to be picked out of the Wehrlich analysis is the detailed factual inquiry that the Supreme Court underwent to make sure that he made a sufficient allegation that he even had a child in the first place and that he intended to live with that child or had at least some relationship with that child. And I think the fact that the court focused on those two facts significantly undercut Mr. Stewart's argument, which would be that the statute in and of itself satisfies the plus requirement. That was all that was necessary. The Supreme Court wouldn't have bothered to look into those detailed facts. And I think that kind of dovetails into what I was driving at, is that there's nothing in the record here that indicates Mr. Stewart has been an inpatient at a hospital or a healthcare facility that meets the definition under the statute. We don't know what information, if any at all, was disclosed about Mr. Stewart to the public under the community notification statutes. And we have nothing in the record to indicate that his life has been affected in any way other than by those notification provisions, other than the fact that he has to register and he's subject to those provisions in the first place.
Counsel, let me interrupt for a minute. It seems to me that the statute would suggest much more interference in a person's life in terms of housing and employment. Those aren't really speculative. Those are going to have an impact on this appellant and on others. Do you want to address that? Do we really need a lot of findings of fact to know that people have an impact from housing and employment requirements?
I think what I would like to respond with is there is nothing in the predatory offender registration statute or the community notification statutes that impact Mr. Stewart's ability to be employed or his ability to find housing. There's nothing that says he can't work in a certain area or in a certain field. There's nothing that says he can't live in housing other than with children. And I think that argument in and of itself is addressed by the Wehrlich decision. So I do believe that in order to satisfy the due the stigma plus test under the due process, procedural due process arguments, he does have to show a specific injury. And I think that that case law is fairly clear and it's laid out in Wehrlich. And if there is no injury, if the injury is merely speculative, the claim's not ripe. I do appreciate, I think I'll finish my train of thought with regard to procedural due process and see how much time I have left. I think another issue with Mr. Stewart's arguments about the stigma plus doctrine is his failure to recognize two of the Court of Appeals' most recent published decisions on this issue, the registration statute, and whether or not it meets the stigma plus test. Those are Thibodeau and the Badeau decisions, and those both specifically address the post-Boughton amendments to 243.166, and they both indicate that, at least from those two panels' perspectives, that the new requirements don't tip the scale, so to speak. They don't change the analysis that the Supreme Court engaged in Boughton.
In reading our case law, Mr. Olson, how important do you think it is that we track similarities of procedural history? And here's the one I would point out for you between this case and Wehrlich. In this case, Mr. Stewart was not just required to register. He is ultimately charged with failure to register and convicted of that and has now a felony for that. The Supreme Court did not have that in the Wehrlich case. And maybe that explains how carefully they analyzed justiciability. Disability. What about these other decisions that you rely on, Thibodeau and Badeau? I mean, are those also similar to Mr. Stewart's position of having not just been required to register, but now after having failed to register, he has been convicted of a new felony?
I don't believe that in the Thibodeau or the Badeau decisions that either of those defendants had been found guilty of failure to register. I believe they were more similarly situated to Wehrlich, where they were challenging the requirement to register in the first place. But I do think tracking the procedural history is very important. And I think the reason is it goes to the remedy in this situation. What should this court do if it decides that some of the post-Boughton or post-LaFontaine requirements of these statutes are unconstitutional? And I raised that very briefly at the end of my supplementary brief, but I think plea withdrawal in this situation is inappropriate because this court can use what's called as-applies severance, which essentially means if a certain statutory amendment is unconstitutional as applied, that amendment is severed from the statute and the previous version is revived. And if you look closely at the reason that Mr. Stewart is required to register in the first place and the facts that he admitted to that gave rise to his conviction for failure to register, the court will find that he's required to register and he's guilty of failing to register under the statutes that existed at the time that Boughton was decided. And if that's the case, I don't see how it would be appropriate to allow him to withdraw his plea. If that were the relief, he would be recharged under the statute that is constitutional and he would be almost certainly reconvicted and there would be really no relief for Mr. Stewart. I think with the last few minutes here, I'll try to spend some time on the substantive due process claims. I'd like to compare and contrast in a little bit more detail the versions of the predatory offender statute that we're dealing with. So we've got the 1998 version that was at issue in Boughton, and we've got the 2019 version that's at issue here. This panel has already recognized that those two versions are significantly different. I don't disagree with that in any way, but I do think that there are at least three things that have to inform the court's analysis when it decides whether or not we've reached the tipping point. In other words, whether the current version that's at issue of that statute is punitive. The first thing I think that should be pointed out is that the core tenets of the statute are the same. The basic requirement of the statute is for someone who's required to register to provide information. And that information has a couple of purposes. One is to help officers find offenders when they need to. The information that's relevant to that inquiry is address information, work, school information, vehicle information, phone numbers. Other types of information are meant to help officers solve new crimes. And I think the information that has to be provided that's relevant to that inquiry are the DNA samples, fingerprints, pictures of defendants, things like that.
Counsel, would you address the seventh factor in the Mendoza-Martinez analysis? That is to say, whether the sanction is excessive in relation to the purpose, public safety. I mean, in terms of public safety, we could, if we're trying to serve public safety, we could just keep adding to the statute, seems to me, and suggest that's necessary for public safety. Where's that line drawn? Would you say it's excessive now?
I would not. And I think that that raises a good point, is that when the legislature is creating statutes that affect liberties, they have to be careful with what they do. They have to make sure that they are accomplishing their goal. One of those goals would be to get a cohort of individuals that they believe are dangerous or risk to the community, and that should fall within these statutes. And that was kind of the blunt instrument that the statute created in the 90s, and it's been refining it ever since. And I don't think that the fact that the legislature is refining the law is evidence that it's attempting to punish offenders or defendants. I think the fact that the legislature is refining the law is evidence that it's closing the gaps.
Is it closing the gap, counsel, or would a cynic suggest that every time they add another sanction, it's politically popular, and you know, public safety might have been addressed a long time ago, but we keep adding sanctions, perhaps?
I get that position, and I can see why people make that argument. I think the point here, though, is that the additions that have been added since Boughton, or at least the bigger, more controversial ones, do have a valid public purpose. So we're talking about notification requirements when a person is an inpatient at a healthcare facility, notification requirements when a predatory offender is going to live with a child, a detailed process for when someone doesn't have a primary address where they otherwise would probably slide under the requirements of the statute. I think all of those big items, yeah, they take up a lot of text in the statute and they're not exactly crystal clear, but when you break down their goal, I think they do make sense and they do advance the purpose of the statute.
I want to circle back to the beginning of the discussion about substantive due process. And the first question is whether or not a statute is criminal or punitive in nature. And as Ms. Graff noted, her client's been found guilty. And so tell me why the statute isn't criminal or punitive in nature.
I want to just make sure that we're addressing substantive due process. I think I may have misheard you wrong.
Yeah, I am substantive due process.
Okay. So I think both of the things that I was just discussing do weigh in on that conversation. I think the most important point that I'd like to make to this panel about that discussion, whether this statute has become punitive or not, is that the Court of Appeals issued a reported decision upholding the 2014 version of the statute. And that was the LaFontaine case that I cited in my brief. And so when the court is determining whether or not the scales have been tipped, so to speak, the court's not going back to 1998, the court's going back to 2014. And if you look very closely at the amendments that have been implemented since then, I believe there's only one that's even worth discussing. There's a lot of very minor tweaks, eliminating superfluous language, but there was one amendment that's fairly substantive, and those provisions took effect August 1st of 2019. But there's really only four changes from my perspective. I didn't get to lay them out in my brief, but I can discuss them here. One is the requirement that offenders provide a DNA sample. That's already required for people like Mr. Stewart who were charged and survived a probable cause hearing in a felony case. I should note too that people like Mr. Stewart are also required to provide fingerprints and photographs of themselves, even if they're booked into a jail. And the statutes that discuss those requirements are 299C.10 and 0.105. The 2019 amendment also required offenders to provide their phone numbers, cell phone, work, home. I think that makes common sense if part of the purpose of the statute is to help law enforcement find offenders. I've noticed my time is up here, so I can finish this chain of thought if the court would like me to otherwise.
Please finish your chain of thought and then we'll turn to Ms. Graff.
Okay. The other change in that 2019 amendment, there was a change to the definition of healthcare facilities to include home care providers, which basically is if there's someone who's providing a service in the offender's home. And then the last change that I think is relevant is that the offenders are now required to provide information about their motor vehicle or more detailed information. And so, yes, there are changes since 2014, but are they so significant that they render a statute that's been considered civil and regulatory for many, many years, now criminal or punitive? I would assert that they do not. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Ms. Graff.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to begin with respondents' reliance on LaFountain, Bedeau, and Thibodeau. And I think that it is misplaced. Those cases all come in the wake of Boughton and rely heavily on Boughton. LaFountain relies on Boughton as its guide, as well as Kaiser versus State, which itself relied heavily on Boughton. Boughton, it's now clear, is no longer controlling. And I think given the changes to the statute, is no longer persuasive, and that given the court's decision in Wuerlick and those changes to the statute, this court can comfortably and soundly let go of that reasoning.
So, counsel, I just want to pause for a brief second on that comment. You know, Wuerlick did not overturn Boughton. I mean, they were pretty careful in their discussion about and appeared to only examine ways in which the registration statute was different today as applied to Mr. Wuerlick than it was at the time of the Boughton case. So I think, at least from my standpoint, you haven't persuaded me yet that I can just simply be comfortable disregarding Boughton. I'm not there yet. So I don't know if you want to expound on that. I'll defer to you. It's your rebuttal time.
Certainly. I guess the analysis in Boughton, every factor that was considered and the stigma plus analysis in Boughton is tied to the registration statute and its scope at that time. And Mr. Wuerlick's or Mr. Stewart's challenges here are premised on the operation of the statute as a whole. It's not a question of whether there is this provision or that provision that is added since that year. We're looking at whether the statute as a whole is punitive, whether the statute as a whole works to operate to alter Mr. Stewart's legal status. And I think that gets to the remedy question that respondent has raised. And I think it misses the constitutional problem. The request here is not to strike down bits and pieces of the registration obligation. Stewart's argument is that those are untouched as they apply to those that are actually convicted of a predatory offense. As it relates to those that were charged with but never convicted, have no proven predatory behavior, that is the constitutional issue. And that is why the statute is unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Stewart. So the remedy here, if there's any severance, is not to sever again bits and pieces, but it's to strike down that portion of the statute or find it unconstitutional as applied to those without any proven predatory history. I think that also gets to respondents' arguments about the core tenets of the statute and whether it, I think some of the things that were being discussed have to do with whether this is, there survives a rational basis test. Focusing on the core tenets focuses or sort of defaults to a Boughton analysis, which the Wuerlick court has said that does not control anymore. And So I think focusing on those core tenets, again, is not appropriate and would be inconsistent with Wehrlich. In addition, I don't think that the statute was a blunt instrument in the 90s. I think that it was a narrowed instrument that has over time really expanded its reach and become a blunt instrument, especially as it relates to, again, those not ever convicted of a predatory offense. When you have widening obligations, increased monitoring that in all reality mimic the conditions that are imposed on parole or probation, and now you're applying them to those with no proven predatory history, we become unconnected to any rational purpose that the state has in trying to improve public safety or solve crimes. Predatory offenders have been required to register on the theory that they're going to recidivate or victimize the same types of people over and over again. And that's why it would serve public safety or the interest in solving crime. But when, again, you have this large system of monitoring applied to those with no proven history, we no longer have something to ground the state's interests. I also want to note that the state, I think, runs up against a logical tension in arguing repeatedly that the statute is not punitive. But at the same time, this rigorous sort of civil regulatory statute doesn't alter Stewart's legal status for purposes of a stigma plus doctrine. It seems that it would have to, at a minimum, be one or the other, and that, you know, the injury for that claim is the reputational injury, which has unquestionably occurred. And the only remaining question is, does that, you know, even if it's not punitive, rigorous statute alter his legal status? And I believe it does.
Thank you very much. It's an important case and interesting arguments. So thank you, Ms. Graff and Mr. Olson. The case is submitted and we will get our decision out in the statutory time. That concludes this hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you.